Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota number 4 best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.
On October 31st, Halloween, Senator Chris Murphy sent a letter to Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. Murphy is a Democrat from Connecticut who sits on the Senate's Foreign Relations Committee. And he had some questions about Twitter, specifically about the Saudi stake in Twitter. The Kingdom Holding Company and the private office of Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal owned Twitter shares worth $1.89 billion. They held on to that stake when Twitter went private under Elon Musk's control. The Saudis are now the second largest investor in Twitter, which, for Murphy, raises some potential national security concerns that he would like to see evaluated by the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, also known as CFIUS. In a press conference on Wednesday, President Biden seemed to agree.
I think that Elon Musk's cooperation and or technical relationships with other countries is worthy of being looked at. Whether or not he is doing anything inappropriate, I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting that it's worth being looked at. But that's all I'll say.
So I called up Senator Murphy on Thursday afternoon to talk about it and some of the other major tech challenges facing Congress. Senator, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to do a quick disclosure that we did go to college together, though you were 2 years ahead of me, but just so that's out there.
Older and wiser.
I'm going to get right to it. You asked for CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., to review Saudi Arabia's stake in Twitter. Do you know if that review is currently happening?
I don't. I've made the request. I have not heard a response. I think it's pretty standard practice for CFIUS to take a look at a major foreign investment like this in a pretty significant social media and communications company, and I hope to hear from them soon.
It seemed like the president backed your desire for some sort of retroactive investigation on Wednesday. That must have been encouraging.
It was.
Why do you think he's interested in this now?
Well, I mean, listen, I think that there's a real question as to why the Saudis didn't take their money out like most everybody else did. Like, I think it would have been financially wise for them to do. The Saudis may have kept their money in, given promises Musk made to them about things he would do with respect to content that the Saudis didn't like. It just makes sense for us to investigate exactly why the Saudis decided to participate with Musk in this purchase and what the implications are for the United States. I mean, let's just be clear. Musk is presenting his purchase as a means to promote free speech. The Saudis are an unlikely partner if Musk is buying Twitter in order to open up channels of political dissent. The Saudis' interest is exactly the opposite. And so I just think it makes sense for us to try to understand exactly what the Saudis are getting out of this. If it's just a financial investment, there's no strings attached. Maybe CFIUS blesses it and it moves forward, but we should at least ask those questions.
You raised your concerns to Secretary Yellen on October 31st, Halloween. Have you gotten any feedback from Treasury since then?
I haven't. We've, you know, also expressed an interest to the White House. And frankly, I think it's time for us to all step back and reconsider what I think is going to be a growing trend of foreign nations investing in U.S. media companies and social media platforms. Frankly, the Saudis' investment in Twitter freaks me out less than the Chinese government's relationship to TikTok. I think it's probably time for us to sort of really think about what it means for political debate, what it means for the health of our kids and families, that these big foreign governments, often adversaries of the United States, increasingly have a pretty clear line into our most important means of communication.
You know, I was actually about to ask you about TikTok. Marco Rubio and Mike Gallagher have just basically said the app should be banned in America. Do you agree with that?
I mean, I think if we can't unwind the Chinese government's connection with TikTok, the downside outweighs the upside. Listen, my kids are addicted to TikTok, but it's candy. I mean, it's not providing a ton of value, and it can be so easily manipulated by the Chinese to promote either sort of quiet or very loud propaganda. The information they have the ability to collect on our kids and Americans in general is incredibly scary. So, I mean, I get that a lot of people love TikTok. I get that it is an incredibly powerful medium for artists to communicate. So I maybe shouldn't be so harsh on the product. It's an important product, obviously has a lot of value for people in this country, but the security concerns around TikTok, the way in which the Chinese can gather information, the way in which they can message to Americans is, I think, really scary.
Do you have similar national security concerns about Starlink and Elon Musk's tweets about Russia and about Ukraine?
My primary concern right now is about Elon Musk's partners. But I think President Biden is perhaps opening up a broader conversation about questions we may need to ask about Musk's business relationships in Russia and in China. I don't have deep knowledge of those relationships, but as he, you know, continues to increase his influence and his ownership stake in critical U.S. companies, it makes sense to just make sure we know the extent of his relationships with foreign governments.
I mean, CFIUS has the authority to retroactively undo acquisitions, which it did do during the Trump administration. I mean, would you like to see that happen with Twitter?
I'm not prejudging the findings here. I think CFIUS should sort of require some disclosure about the agreements that may or may not exist between the Saudis, this particular fund, Kingdom Holdings, and Twitter. It may be that CFIUS comes to the conclusion that there isn't any nefarious intent, but we should at least ask the questions. And hopefully, with President Biden's comments this week, that process will begin.
You know, one of the things you wrote in your letter was that if CFIUS doesn't act, then Congress should. And I wonder both what that would look like and also whether Elon Musk would even listen to you all. After all, he has repeatedly thumbed his nose at the SEC and the FTC.
As you referenced, there is a growing bipartisan interest in foreign government ownership and stake in U.S. media companies. It is true, for the time being, it seems as if Elon Musk is a bit of a darling inside the Republican Party, and so query whether people like Marco Rubio or Representative Gallagher would be as interested in taking on the question of Elon Musk's partners in Twitter as they are about the Chinese stake in TikTok. But I do think that there is going to be some growing bipartisan consensus that we should be really careful about foreign governments owning companies that have this broad access to Americans' private information. So I don't think that Elon Musk should feel that he is immune from either investigation or regulation, because I think this train is coming. There's not a lot of bipartisan agreement in Washington, but the Venn diagram increasingly has a lot of dark shade when it comes to foreign governments' ownership of technology companies.
You're one of the younger members of the Senate. You are actually on Twitter a decent amount. What do you think of the platform since he's taken over?
I mean, I haven't seen so far a lot of changes that directly impact me. Yesterday for 2 hours.
Nobody's paying $8 and saying, I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm not paying. All right. I don't. Well, there's plenty of, you know, accounts out there with my name attached to it. But I'm lucky that I have enough followers that people don't need the blue check to know which one is me. Yesterday, I had a new little tag attached to my name for about 2 hours before it disappeared. So clearly there's a lot of experimentation happening in the early days of Elon Musk's tenure there. But I haven't, you know, been amongst those who have been, you know, apocalyptic about the experience as a user. I'm willing to give him time. I have gained a lot of value from Twitter over the years as a means through which I communicate my ideas, a means through which I talk to my constituents. It's the way that I get a lot of my political information. So I'm hoping that it stays you know, a platform that has a lot of utility for people like me. And I'm willing to, you know, adopt a bit of a wait and see approach. And so, you know, I don't want my interest in the Saudi stake to give the impression that I am, you know, piling on. I think Elon Musk has done a lot of really beneficial things for the world. I think his technology is world-changing, and we should appreciate what he has done with respect to battery technology and electric vehicle technology. And I don't necessarily think that he's an illegitimate owner of Twitter. I just want to make sure that it remains a place where, you know, both sides get hurt equally.
When we come back, more with Senator Chris Murphy.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotarucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights. Gay rights now! Gay rights! With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
I want to ask you about a piece you wrote for The Atlantic about neoliberalism, and there's some thoughts about technology in there. And you said that Democrats, not Republicans, are the natural party to make sure that technology works for people instead of people working for technology. And yet, Democrats have been in power in the House and the Senate and the presidency, and the two big, you know, bills that are supposed to quote unquote take on big tech are just sort of languishing. Why?
I think it's a mistake. I think that we should be pushing forward legislation that, you know, both sort of breaks up or attempts to control some of these big tech monopolies, but also legislation that protects our kids and our data and our privacy.
I mean, should they come to the floor in the lame duck session?
I don't know that we're going to have time to bring them to the floor in the lame duck session, because we're going to have to process in the Senate a ton of nominees, a budget, a handful of other really important pieces of legislation. But I would hope that this is at the top of our agenda next year. Listen, I think that there is a broad national exhaustion with the pace of technological change. I think there are a lot of families out there, a lot of parents who feel like technology is sort of owning them instead of technology working for them. And they want to know when their kids are on these sites that they're protected. And they don't feel that way right now. So to me, there's a lot of space for Democrats to lead on the issue of tech regulation, of protecting our data, protecting our kids. And I think that it should be at the top of our agenda next year. Right now, I think a lot of Americans think that Republicans are the sort of more legitimate tech critics. But they, as I argue in that Atlantic piece, are so antithetical or so allergic to government regulation that I don't think they'll ever be able to pass the kind of legislation that families want.
Right, but Democrats haven't passed it and they've been in power.
I agree. So let's change that. I think we have had other priorities. I think that there, you know, is a subset of the Democratic Party that believes in this neoliberal view that technology only exists in a beneficial cycle of innovation, and that regulations would stifle this as a growth industry in the United States. I don't believe those things. I think tech will continue to grow in the United States, even if we have more significant regulation. And I just think the Democratic Party needs to start acting with more purpose when it comes to technology policy.
Before I let you go, because I know you're on a tight schedule, I can't have you here just after the midterms and not ask you about them. I know that you're happy about everything in Connecticut, but I'm really curious about what your party is going to do to keep turnout up in Georgia. Obviously, that runoff is going to be incredibly important. Independents might stay home. The 18-year-olds who just turned 18 cannot vote there because of a voting change or a law change. What do you all do?
Well, I think that the more focus on Herschel Walker, the worse it is for him. Remember, he was sort of sharing the stage with a governor who, you know, turned out to be pretty broadly popular. He doesn't get to share that stage any longer. It's just Herschel Walker. And I do not think he's going to stand up very well to this new solo spotlight that he will have. I don't think there's any doubt that our level of energy is going to be sky high, because I think
you're not really answering my turnout question. You're talking about Herschel Walker.
Well, how are we going to keep turnout up?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're going to raise a ton of money to make sure that we knock on everybody's door. A handful of us just raised close to $1 million in about 12 hours last night online for Raphael Warnock. And, you know, I think that you're going to, I think that spirits are buoyed inside the Democratic Party. I mean, I think there was a little bit of, you know, hopelessness out there. A lot of folks stayed home in part because, you know, they might have believed the hype that this was just going to be a big Republican wave year. So I think in the face of what happened last night, you will actually see Democratic constituency groups, Democratic voters, energized and come out to the polls to support Reverend Warnock. And again, I think that spotlight focused on Herschel Walker will also help turnout. I think the more people see of Herschel Walker, the more interested a lot of low propensity voters will have in coming out and making sure that he's not their U.S. Senator.
Senator Chris Murphy, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Chris Murphy is the junior senator from Connecticut. And that is it for our show today. What Next TBD is produced by Evan Campbell. Our show is edited by Jonathan Fisher and Tori Bosch. Joanne Levine is the executive producer for What Next. Alicia Montgomery is vice president of audio for Slate. TBD is part of the larger What Next family, and we are also part of Future Tense, a partnership of Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. And if you're a fan of this show, I have a request for you. Become a Slate Plus member. You get all your Slate podcasts ad-free. Just head on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. We will be back on Sunday with another episode. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota #4 best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queen say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.